This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Therapy. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P. We'll come back to them in the middle of the episode. My guest today, and I'm very excited about it, is Kevin Kelly, one of the original gang of people at Wired Magazine in the early 90s, and he remains listed on the masthead of Wired as a senior maverick. He's a longtime techno-optimist who worked with people like Stuart Brand at the old Whole Earth Catalog, Whole Earth Review, and Coevolution Quarterly, and he's published books, a shelf full of books, including 1992's Out of Control, which helped really popularize the idea of emergent order and self-regulating systems as preferable to more traditional, old-fashioned, top-down systems of control. Since 2000, he's published Cool Tools, a website which recommends the best and cheapest tools available, and he's one of the people behind the absolutely great Recommendo, a weekly Substack newsletter that suggests interesting gadgets, books, and other offerings if you're at all into digital culture, technology, online, everything. His new book is Excellent Advice for Living, Wisdom I Wish I'd Known Earlier. We're going to talk about that book, his career as a public intellectual, how his Christianity informs his science and vice versa, and not only why he believes optimism always wins in the long run, but is absolutely warranted by the facts on the ground. Here is the Reason interview with Kevin Kelly. Kevin Kelly, great to talk to you.
It's really a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate your attention.
Yeah. Let's start with the elevator pitch for the book. Why did you write Excellent Advice for Living, and what is it about?
This book is a little compendium of about 450 little aphorisms, proverbs, things that I was jotting down for a while just to help remind myself to change my habits, to become a better person. And at some point, I realized that we're not very preachy with my three kids who are now young adults, that it would, some of this stuff that I've been writing down for myself, I wished I'd known earlier. So I made a form of it when I was 68 years old on my birthday and did the Irish Hobbit thing of trying to give a gift on my birthday. And I gave the gift of a list of 68 things to my children, which I also posted and went viral. And I was encouraged to do it additional years. And as it grew, I realized that while this existed digitally natively on the internets, it would have been really handy to have into one volume they could hand to somebody. So it's become a paper book that I enjoy giving to other people. And I've heard a few parents saying, my kids don't listen to anything I say, so I have to give them your book because they'll pay attention to someone else outside of the family.
Yeah. So it went from 68 on your 68th birthday. What, you're 71, yeah, exactly. 72 now? Okay. So are you going to live to be 450? Yeah, right, then? Exactly. Is that the hope? Before we talk about some of the actual proverbs, you mentioned the Irish thing. Your name is Kelly. Is being Irish important to you, or how does that inform who you are?
Yeah, it's not that important. I have had almost zero interest in my genealogy. I don't really care. I have heard that our ancestors came from Galway in Ireland, probably maybe four generations ago or so. I don't know much about them. I don't have that much interest in that kind of thing. I'm married to a Chinese. My kids are bilingual and Hapa, as we say. So, and that thrills me, actually.
Why does it thrill you?
I find the hybrid vigor to be an important aspect. I think what we'd like to do is keep interbreeding until we're all brown. I don't think that really will happen, but I like fusion. I like the idea of colliding differences and making something new. And there is something about the intersection of cultures between, say, Chinese and California that I find thrilling.
Before we get to the property, now I'm making all these detours, but so you're not particularly interested in your Irishness, which on some level makes sense because the Irish, if anything, are a pessimistic people. You're very optimistic. You, if I was reading your biography correctly, you grew up in New Jersey or finished your formal education there, but then you invoked California. I suspect you don't care that much about New Jersey either.
I left as soon as I could after high school and really haven't been back. I went back to a 50th high school reunion recently to my place to witness a tree. When I was 17 years old, I planted a oak tree in my backyard from an acorn with the hope that in 50 years I'd go back and see a really big tree. And there it was. There was this huge oak tree there. So, the standard bit of advice, the best time to plant an oak tree is 50 years ago. The second best time is today.
I think that's in the book. Exactly. Exactly, right?
So I don't have a much, I have no attachment to New Jersey. It wasn't working for me. I'm living in California and I identify as a Californian because California is where there is the least resistance to new ideas. And that's where I want to be living.
Do you feel that is still the case? Okay. So can you talk a little bit about that? Because a lot of people talk about how, California, it seemed to be that way. And now it's kind of ossified. People are leaving the state, businesses, the kind of apparatus of control of business, political controls and everything seems to be very strong there. Is it that is not keeping people at bay from coming up with new ideas or doing that kind of hybridizing and mongrelizing?
I think it's debatable about whether it is worse here now than before. But what all I can say is that there is no other place that has less resistance to new ideas than California. So people may be moving, but where are they moving to? All right.
Texas and Florida.
Okay, yeah. Well, Miami does not have less resistance to new ideas than Silicon Valley, and neither does Austin. So I want to live in the area where there is the least resistance comparatively. So maybe it's not as resistance-free as it was a couple of years ago, but I think it's actually debatable about whether it is. When I intersect with people here, I am still encountering more new ideas per capita than anywhere else that I have seen.
You are part of a tradition, really, that stretches back at least 50 years, in the 60s and coming out of that, where California not only became the most populous state, but it really kind of defined the American character for the, at least the second half of the 20th century. What was it about California that made it so receptive to, all sorts of ideas, all sorts of living arrangements, all sorts of, again, we come back to this idea I love in your work, talking about hybridization and collision, mongrelization, all of that. What is it, the water? Is it the weather? What is it in California that made that happen?
There's another aspect of these things, which is the edge. So there's a whole multiple theories about why, but most of them have to do with the distance that California was from the East Coast center of power. And initially, it was settled by young men who were aimless and came out to prospect for gold. And California was unique among all the places in the world where the government did not claim the gold. Anybody could come out and stake a claim and could work on it. So you didn't need to ask permission. And that idea of not asking for permission and no adult supervision was at the core of the settlement of California. And that sort of extended later on throughout the Bohemian times, throughout the beatniks and the hippies, which was no adult supervision, don't ask permission. just go ahead. And I think Silicon Valley, the origins of Silicon Valley, you're basically a breakaway from the, it was a version of trying to do government work without government money, without government approval. So you had the Lockheed Skunk Works and all kinds of attempts, including the startup culture, which was because there wasn't funding for these things from, there wasn't easy funding. You had to find your own. And so Silicon Valley is also kind of an extension of the same idea of a culture, a history where you didn't ask permission, but you kind of went and did it yourself.
What is the role of, you know, you say it was hard to get funding or it wasn't funded, but within the tech culture and Silicon Valley culture, and both Southern California, but certainly the Bay Area, there was a lot of defense spending there. So, you know, and it's always been an interesting, you know, kind of tension and a kind of libertarian techno-optimism that, you know, a lot of this stuff, including in some ways, you know, it's usually overplayed, but that the internet itself kind of started in a military lab or a series of funded. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Tension? So you're absolutely right. There continues to be, and also we don't ordinarily appreciate or reckon the role of government funding of science in things like the iPhone and GPS and et cetera. So it's very, very important. It's not as if this is entirely self-sufficient, that the Silicon Valley and our kind of technological culture relies tremendously on government and regulation. But out of all those things, you know, the military industrial complex, the true innovation of Silicon Valley came from the Skunk Works, this idea that you have this sort of you carve out these little bits of an area where you don't need permission, where you can kind of go really fast and break things, et cetera, and that you work with that in the context of this larger system. So I reject this idea that there is any kind of self-sufficiency, that we don't need government, that we don't need regulation. But there is a way in which you can work with that system by segregating, isolating, by having and modeling areas where you allow for this genesis to happen. You kind of protect it in some ways, and you have rules about it. And so that's sort of the genius, is that it's not the Wild Wild West as it was. It's sort of the new Wild West.
Yeah, I guess we called them temporary autonomous zones, back in the 90s and things like that.
Part of it, you know, the Burning Man ethos, where you have these little zones. Charter cities is another little idea there, where you and so you could think of Silicon Valley as a cultural charter city in some ways.
Yeah. I love the image of the garage as a place, you know, built for one thing, built to house cars or whatever, but then it ended up, you know, being the place where a number of fabulously liberating and wonderful and, you know, value producing companies were founded. Do you feel like Silicon Valley, I mean, now, you know, if you look at the kind of, you know, version of it that we're talking about, it really starts in the late 50s and in the 60s. Is it like a lot of people born in the late 50s and early 60s, kind of getting a little bit self-satisfied in middle age or late middle age? Are the arteries hardening there in a way that is very different, you know, than it was 20 years ago or 50 years ago?
I'm not sure. I would say it's very different. Whether it's aging and ossifying, it's hard to tell. So it's always compared to what? So we don't have the natural life cycle of a Silicon Valley organism before us that we can compare to what it should be or what happens ordinarily. So whether it's ossifying or actually deepening and complexifying, those may not be the same thing. So I would certainly say that it's become more complicated and more complex, but I'm not sure I would say it's ossifying.
Okay. Let's look at some of the specific proverbs in the book. And one of the things I was struck by, you know, in your work, again, you talk about, you know, going fast and breaking things, but you also have a respect for tradition and history. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, and one of the things about the contemporary world is that, you know, many of the things that you and I even took for granted in our childhood just don't really exist in the same form, you know, whether it's your particular vision of the family or of sexuality or what kind of clothes you wear to work, what work looks like. So we need to create our own, you know, traditions and histories, mm-hmm. recognizing that they may not outlast us or we may even give them up. And so with that in mind, here's one of your proverbs here. We lack rites of passage. Create a memorable family ceremony when your child reaches legal adulthood between 18 and 21. This moment will become a significant touchstone in their life. What, you have three kids. What form did that take in your family? And, you know, did it work?
Yeah. So we did work, and we involved our children in making up this invented ritual. And I think it's perfectly okay to make up invented rituals. You only have to do them three times in a row, and then they become legacy. And so for our kids, we had one part of the ritual that was the same with all of them and the other parts that they kind of were involved in. And the part that was the same was we had a moment, and there were mostly family, a very small group of family and some close friends. And we would have a red ribbon tied around our waist and tied around their waist. And then we ceremoniously have the scissors and cut the umbilical cord, cut the cord. Then we would hand them their last checks. Literally, like, this is the last check you're going to get from us. You're on your own. And one of those checks was also, I had made a bet with my parents when I was young, like 10 or 12. I think I'd heard about this from the Kennedy family, where I think his father was going to pay him $1,000 if he didn't drink or smoke. And I said, I'll do that with my dad. So I made this bet that I get $100 if I didn't smoke or drink before 21. And so our kids heard about this, and they wanted to have the same bet, the same promise, whatever it was. And so those who did got the check for $1,000. And then we also had the first toast of their first legal drink. And then the kids had their own little bit of ceremony where my son wanted everybody to write a bit of advice on some edible paper, and then he would read the advice and consume it. And my daughter wanted to be baptized in our hot tub. And another daughter was baking bread. She bread and she fed everybody the bread that she baked, like a communion. And so there were other little bits of that. And that was the sort of the ceremony of like, okay, you're now an adult. Here you are. Here's a little significance. And that moment is something that they cherish.
Yeah. Have the checks actually stopped, or have you?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Checks stopped.
That's great. Yeah. You have, this is one which I, you know, find, I'll just mention it. Promptness is a sign of respect. I feel like that is, you know, that's wisdom that has disappeared. But here's one that I found particularly interesting, because it strikes me. I have two sons who are 29 and 21. And when I think about their experience with this versus mine, it's very different. And you write, before you are old, attend as many funerals as you can bear and listen. Nobody talks about the departed's achievements. The only thing people will remember is what kind of person you were while you were achieving. Expand on that a little bit.
Well, this is an actual experience. This is gained from, unfortunately, because I'm the age I am, I attend more funerals than I have in the past. And I was kind of shocked to hear eulogies and what it was, because they weren't talking about how many patents they had. They weren't talking about their bestsellers. They weren't talking about the billions that they made or were not. They were talking about whether they were nice, how they made them feel. It was like, wow. So this is what's, so this is what I'm going to leave behind. It's like, you want to be aiming for the, you want to be aiming to have a nice eulogy, right? I mean, people say some nice things. That's an emphasis that I think is important to hear when you're young.
Did your children attend a lot of funerals when they were kids? I'm betting that you attended more funerals by the time you were 20 than your kids did. It seems like death used to be more present in our culture, both as a fact, people died younger, but also, you know, kids would attend funerals, which is an interesting kind of reality check.
You're probably right, but I don't. Have our kids attended funerals besides their grandparents? I think you're right about that.
Here's another one about kids, because this is, you know, we're in a moment. I guess we're both baby boomers. We're in a moment where millennials are kind of taking over. And I think it's a shift that's as kind of seismic as it was when boomers really started becoming the main thing in the 80s. Mm-hmm. But you're right. Your 20s are the perfect time to do a few things that are unusual, weird, bold, risky, unexplainable, crazy, unprofitable, and look nothing like success. For the rest of your life, these experiences will serve as your muse. How did that come to you?
It came partly from my own experience and partly from, me observing the people around me and say someone talking about something that they did when they were young that would qualify as completely unprofitable and unnecessary, and how important it became later on to them and maybe making who they were. So, I do these walk and talks with people, remarkable people. We have plenty of time to hear their lives. And I was just struck by how many times they were talking about something that they did when they were young. Seemed, it gets strange and unaccountable at the time, but that later on became something that they could return to, or did return to kind of become a core of what they were going to do later on. So in my own case, that was true too, in terms of being able to travel in Asia and do things that were highly unprofitable, looked nothing like success in a career, and yet became a core of my own view of the future and what I'm doing now.
There, at your website, there's a remarkable map of your wanderings through Asia. And, you're talking about the whole thing from Japan to India and whatnot. What prompted you to go? And is there a ridiculous question, but is there a single takeaway, a kind of top line that you say, this is why, what I got out of this?
The short version was I was reading books. I read Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass, where he was writing this incredible ode to America and its diversity and its labor and what it was doing. And I had never been out of New Jersey, basically. And I was like, I have to see the world. And at that very moment, my best friend, who was studying Chinese in Taiwan, wrote to me and said, why don't you come to Taiwan and photograph? Because that's what I was doing while I'm here. And I thought, okay, I knew nothing, zero about Taiwan. I'd never eaten Chinese food, if you can believe it. I was like 20, 19. I never held chopsticks. I never knew anything. And so this was a complete revelation when I got there. And what, after 50 years of kind of meandering through the most remote parts of Asia, my takeaway was, what I got out of it was, the power of otherness, the power of differences, the power of doing things in a different way, seeing the multitude of different solutions that people would have for basic clothing, shelter, food, how to get things done. And then in addition to Asia, there was a transparency that was uncommon for growing up in New Jersey, which was a sense of privacy being very, very different. So everything was kind of done out in the open. Everything was visible. So I got to see, in a certain sense, how the world was running. And of course, a lot of the world was being manufactured in these places. And so there was a kind of a whole university level course in how the world was working. That was also something I walked away with. And then the third thing was I became much more optimistic. It doubled down on whatever optimism I had, because I could see right before my eyes people who transformed their lives from being struggling with not enough food to becoming very fat and happy, building all kinds of things right before my eyes. And, you know, hundreds of millions of people bootstrapping themselves from poverty to middle class. I saw that.
Yeah.
Right before.
Is, you know, that a wonderful segue into our next kind of discussion topic, which is about optimism. You know, you were traveling in Asia, what, in the early 70s or 70s?
72 was my first trip.
Yeah. And I could see a lot of people going over there. If you go to India or Bangladesh or China at that, you know, for that matter, and everything in between, and saying, you know what, these are countries that are ravaged by war, by immense poverty, by genocide.
Right.
And you know, and this is the future for the rest of us. Mm-hmm. And you came away optimistic. You know, what did you see that they were missing? That the pessimists,
pessimists? I don't know. Were there?
I mean, there are people like Paul Ehrlich, around this time saying, all he sees are teeming masses of starving people, or children being forced into sweatshops, or people struggling to bury the dead in places like Cambodia.
So there was a tremendous amount of poverty. There was a tremendous amount of child indentured servitude. I saw people living their entire lives in India out on the street, and shocking degree of poverty. That was all there. But what I saw was people changing, the change. So there was absolutely, Pol Pot and Cambodia and Bangladesh. But the thing about it was they were changing. There, you haven't heard about a big starvation famine in Bangladesh recently, because they changed. And that's what I saw, as I saw what people were doing to make a difference. And so these new things have problems too, which is part of the whole thing. But I saw what technology could do. I saw what technology could bring to the lives, and the way that people were streaming away from these little villages into the cities, which were teeming and not very nice. They were gritty and grimy, unlike their villages, which were beautiful and organic. But the reason they came into the cities was for one reason, which is they had more choice. They didn't have to be a farmer. They could have the choice of being a mortgage broker or an insurance salesman or a ballerina. And that's why they were putting up with that grit, was they had more choices. And that's where my optimism comes from.
Yeah, isn't it amazing? In like around 2017, 2018, Brookings Institution, using UN data, found that for the first time ever, a majority of the world's population is living at a middle class standard of living. A majority of people. The number of people in dire poverty is well below 10%. Why do we ignore that massive transformation, which is unimaginable 50 years ago, much less 100 years ago?
In general, the problem is that news, by its nature, and news of the highest quality news, is always about bad things, because good things take a long time to happen. So that's over like 20 years or something. So if we had headlines every 20 years, that would be at the top of the headline. But we have headlines every 5 minutes, and it's much more likely in the last 5 minutes that something bad happened than that something good happened, because the good takes a longer time. So part of my change, in my view, has been the shift of my horizon, my time horizon. So if you can elevate your time horizon and look at things over the last 10,000 years, the last 100 years, the last 5 decades, you become much more optimistic. And if you look into the future at the same time scale, you also can be much more optimistic, because with the kind of compounding of only a few percent, you can overcome even fairly large setbacks and depressions. And so that's, so if you take a longer view, you can become much more optimistic.
One of the proverbs you have is that you write, when someone tells you about the peak year of human history, the period of time when things were good before things went downhill, it will always be the year when they were 10 years old, which is the peak of any human's existence. Factor that into what they say. Do you think we have made that a dogma almost?
Oh, yeah.
It's insane, right? I mean, we're living in a term. Elsewhere in the book, you talk about, you know, just the profusion of abundance, but everywhere people seem to be talking from a scarcity mindset.
Right. And so part of it is, I think people haven't traveled enough. Secondly, I think, I mean, to me, it is remarkable that in 2023, that we have to make a case for progress. I think that for me, the denial of progress is very, very problematic. And it's particularly weird coming from progressives, mm-hmm. progressives, you know, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
So it is remarkable that there is not a better acknowledgement of progress. And that, again, that comes back to the impact, or the, what's the word I want? The way that bad things hijack our attention. And so, you know, if you say, well, things are getting better, they'll say, well, what about, you know, what about Ukraine? What about what? Yeah. It's like, those are immediate, in the face, bad things. And they obscure the fact that any rational, scientific, impartial analysis of it is that on average, humans have gotten better and safer and more secure and longer lived. Whatever thing we care about has gotten better over, on average, time. And so, it's a hard argument to I think refute. But we live by anecdotes and stories, and that's what we hear constantly, day and night, is about the latest bad thing that just happened in the last 5 minutes.
Before we continue with the recent interview with Kevin Kelly, I want to talk to you about today's sponsor, BetterHelp Online Therapy. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P. If you are having any sort of trouble in your life, you might benefit from therapy. And I'm here to tell you that BetterHelp is a great service, whether you're feeling anxious, depressed, or just like you're not the best version of yourself. BetterHelp is entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. It's hard to do that in regular meet space. I know BetterHelp is a great service because I used it myself for about 2 years, and it really made a difference. It helped me work through some tough stuff. Visit BetterHelp.com/TRI today to get 10% off your first month. The TRI stands for The Reason Interview. So make sure to get a discount on your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/TRI. And now back to The Reason Interview with Kevin Kelly.
One of the new last bad things is AI. You know, and you have people like Yuval Noah Harari A number of people in Silicon Valley who say this is going to, you know, not just degrade our life, it's going to destroy the planet.
Right.
How do you respond to that kind of AI alarmism?
Yeah, yeah. So I've been trying to figure out why, because these are very, very smart people who are very knowledgeable. Elon Musk and Jeffrey Hinton, who was leading some of the large neural net programs at Google. And of course, Eliza Yudkowsky. I think what I've concluded is that basically, these are very, very smart men who believe that the most important thing and the only important thing in the universe is intelligence. And they're basically overrating intelligence. They think that greater intelligence, however they define it, because we don't have any definition of what it is, and it's probably certainly not a single dimension, but in any sense, they would say greater intelligence will trump everything else. And they're going to say if you put Einstein and Tiger in a cage, Einstein would live because he's smarter. Well, that's ridiculous. And so you need so many other things to accomplish things on Earth. Like if you wanted to kill 8 billion people, you can't just be smarter. You have to also, to get things done in the world, you need other things besides intelligence. It's not the most intelligent person in the room that initially gets the most done. It's not the most intelligent person that will have the biggest company. It's not the most intelligent. It's not the company with the most intelligent people that will actually dominate. Intelligence is way overrated by people who like to think. So they're saying, I like to think, and I think that thinking is the most important thing. And it's the only thing that counts. If you have a lot of it, it trumps everything else. And I say, no, it doesn't work. You need empathy. You need grit. You need enthusiasm. You need perseverance and persistence and all other kinds of things to make things happen in the world. And if you have some black box that's super intelligent, it still can't do anything. It's like being in the cage with the tiger. You need other stuff besides intelligence. And so I think that's what it is.
You in a number of places you say, you know, 90% of success is showing up.
Right.
There is no perfection. There is only kind of reiteration or iteration
iteration. Right.
And it's interesting then that say somebody like Elon Musk, who is certainly smart and intelligent and is working in fields that have the ability to transform how we live, is, you know, works 1,000-hour weeks, right? He's not just doing it while, you know, sitting in a lotus position.
Right. Yeah. But he believes, although it's hard to tell what Elon believes. I don't even want to talk about Elon because I don't think, I think there's a persona of Elon and I think he's giving a performance. He's obviously investing into AI at a huge scale.
Right.
He was original founder of OpenAI. So I don't take anything he says at face value.
Right. In terms of other technologies, and this is certainly something, you know, when you look back at, you know, the early days of the 90s, when a lot of technologies that had obviously been in development for decades, but really kind of emerged in a powerful way and changed the cultural conversation and, you know, the means of cultural production as well as cultural consumption in a profound way. And I think, you know, Wired certainly kind of held that moment and, you know, both helped generate it as well as report on it. There were a lot of tech pessimists in the 90s. There were a lot of people who said this was going to ruin everything. It was destroying, you know, this and that.
The internet was
100% of the internet was porn, all of that. But they were beaten back by optimists or just by the people who ignored them and just built their cathedrals. Now it seems to be very much more widespread that, you know, there is a lot of negativity towards tech, big tech, et cetera. Is any of that pessimism, or maybe not pessimism, but is any of that negativism warranted?
No, I don't. Well, yeah, you're absolutely right that there was, there's a kind of usual, I call a tech panic cycle. And initially is that this stuff isn't working and it's terrible because it doesn't work. And then later on, this stuff is terrible because it works too well. And then later on, this is terrible because it works so well, it's not unevenly distributed. And not everybody has access to it. Okay, well, we're in kind of a similar phase right now of moving from this is terrible because it doesn't work well. It's like facial recognition is terrible because it doesn't work well. Once it starts working well, it's like, well, now it's terrible because it works too well. So I think we're in a typical panic cycle. But more importantly, I think there is something different this time around, which is I think culturally, and maybe to some extent the world, not just the West, we collectively, human culture, has become wise to the fact that new technologies will make new problems. And for now, our initial reaction to anything new is, I know this is going to bite me. What is this wrong with this? It's like, unlike, say, in the 50s when I was growing up and had new technologies, people say, wow, it's amazing. I can't wait to have that. No one was saying, I know that this is going to, you know, supersonic jetpacks, going to burn up people's behinds or whatever it was. Right. There was the initial reaction was enthusiasm and can't wait. Now the very first reaction we have is, I know that there's something wrong with this because there's always going to be a problem.
Is that a problem of the people, or is it more of the kind of managerial elites? Because, you know, I'm thinking as you're saying that, I agree, but then it's ChatGPT, you know, had hundreds of millions of downloads the minute that it became available. So it seems like people are kind of interested in it, but all we hear from members of Congress and the tech elite is, we got to slow down. We got to regulate this. We got to control it.
So, yeah, I think you're right. I think we've been trained by Hollywood and everyone else to understand that there are negatives. And that's the first question we ask. But then the second question is, how can I get it as fast as possible? So, I mean, we're sort of trained to understand that there are downsides to this, but that does not seem to stop people from actually using it because there are benefits to it. So I think it is a little bit of a, what's the word I want? A cultural ritual? A cultural ritual to bring forth the negative before we actually go and use it all the time?
Mm-hmm. Do you, you know, when you talk about the tech panic cycle, is there a reliable, you know, kind of way of getting out of these? Like, what happens to get us out? Is it just the technology proves useful, or does something new come along? Because it is worrying right now that, you know, we seem, I don't think we're quite at the level of burning our boats or anything like that. But, you know, as a society, and I'm just thinking of American culture now,
we
seem more fearful of the present and the future. We're blind to any kind of progress. And people seem to be reaching, whether it's on the political right or the left, whether it's certain types of conservatives or progressives, they want to, you know, slow down and put things in control, you know, in a way that is redolent of, you know, maybe of the moment when you wrote Out of Control.
Yeah. I haven't seen a way out of or bypassing the tech panic cycle. I think we just have to go through it. Maybe we can go through it faster. If there are in other countries, I'm trying to see what China is doing because I have spent a lot of time there. And they seem to have their own maybe version of it. So I'm not sure that they're going to escape it either. I have seen no evidence of how we can escape it other than to understand that we're going through it is for right. me, the first step is saying, well, this is, we can expect this and the next stage will be this. And maybe we go through it faster, which also does seem to be happening. If, you know, it's sort of like, it's like an adolescence. I don't know if you can escape the pattern of adolescence, but being aware of it and that it's not, that you're not alone, that it's not, that it's normal, can take a lot of the pain of it. And so maybe that's what I would suggest as a first step is let's just acknowledge that there's there and that we're going through it and that this is a phase of like grief, you know, whatever, that this is the phase we're in. And so it's necessary to go through it.
Yeah, it's somewhere you write it. I might be mangling it a bit, but it's that pain is not optional, but suffering is optional, right?
Right.
You know, speaking of China and kind of revelations of the ways in which big tech, you know, or social media companies, for, you know, is I guess the word we're using now, Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, during COVID worked very closely with the government to, you know, restrict or, you know, deplatform people who were carrying misinformation, disinformation, malinformation, all of these phrases. You have that in the United States. In China, a lot of people say, you know, what is different this time? You know, Orwell, you know, was merely talking about the Stalinist Soviet Union, where they had crappy technology, but China has perfected technology that's been, you know, mostly produced or created in the West. So it's very different. Do you buy that, or that the way that the tech lords are now working with the government, that we're in a kind of techno dystopia that is different than the past?
I don't think we're in techno dystopia at all. You know, we're having a fight about what we accept as acceptable speech. And that's, we haven't really had to have that in the past. Right. And now we're having this, you know, is what are you allowed to say or not so to say culturally? And that's something that we never had to articulate to such written down rules before, but we're going through this process and a lot of people have very different ideas and that's only natural. China is creating a surveillance state, but what's interesting, what I find interesting about it is that we are too, but China is much more overt about it and they may actually arrive in the long term, not with the CCP, but in the long term, they may arrive at a way of civilizing this in a way that we don't, because we're so allergic to it that we don't want to wrestle with it.
What do you mean? What are we allergic to?
Constant monitoring.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Constant monitoring in public, like the idea of this idea that we shouldn't have facial recognition, which is really weird to me, because obviously we have facial recognition. I can recognize you. And that's, to me, your face is your most personal thing and your most public thing. So who owns your face? Well, I would say to a large extent, the public owns your face in the sense that we need your face. Your face is your recognition, how we can identify you. And so there's a whole element of our lives being monitored that the Chinese are for going forward. And I think what they have right now is really not sustainable, but they may come to something that's sustainable and civil before we do, because we just are kind of refusing it. And the Chinese are using data collection to do what I would call evidence-based policy. Their idea is that they want to have a policy, you know, public policy based on the evidence of what people actually do and how they live their lives, versus America, which is making policy based on ideology, some idea, some theme.
Does it matter that, you know, in China, it seems that the individual citizen has, you know, they have more choice than they had 20 years ago, but they have much less choice than we have here. You know, for instance, to go back to your discussion of skunk works,
right.
Is it possible in China, and I suspect that it is actually, but in these massive cities, even with, you know, perfect surveillance, there's a lot of dark corners, there's a lot of garages where people are working on things, but isn't that the fear that China doesn't allow the individuals to make the decisions that then kind of give rise to patterns we can actually use?
That is absolutely the fear. And as I said, the current system of China is not sustainable. But because they don't have the same allergy to us in kind of having a monitored society, I think they may be out ahead of us in the future in discovering ways in which we can civilize this. Because if we take what's coming with, say, augmented reality, the vision glasses from Apple, all this kind of stuff, we are going to be recording, or at least monitoring, or at least capturing our behavior all the time in a digital way. That's a huge amount of information. That's a huge amount of powerful data. And what happens with it? Who owns it? Who controls it? These are all open questions. But in some ways, I think China is much more likely to arrive at something that not the current Communist Party state, but China as a society, bigger than just the current government, that they may arrive at this because they don't have the same allergy that we have to this. They have a slightly different social contract about people in public than we do. And I think we're going to have a harder time wrestling with the issues of, is your face a public resource or not?
I also wonder if, you know, the constant monitoring, which, you know, on a certain level, it, you know, it can be a panopticon and it is an instrument of social control, but it's also, I know tons of people who voluntarily are now continuously monitoring their glucose, their blood glucose and other things because they want the feedback loop. So, I mean, there are so many different levels and do you opt in? Can you opt out? All of this kind of stuff. When you say the current Chinese government or the current society is unsustainable, is that because You know, the attempts by governments to try and control and regulate and restrict every aspect of individual life always fails, or is it unsustainable because the technology isn't good enough yet?
I think my bias is that I talk about, you know, prototyping your life instead of making grand plans, and this idea of iteration and getting to things through multiple versions and creeping forward. I call that failure management system. And the idea is you want to have failures often, small, frequent, forward, better, rather than single catastrophic failures like we're kind of seeing in Russia. So if you block the natural ongoing failures that you have in kind of an open system, then you're going to have your failures become more catastrophic and big and occasional. And so that's the problem with the current regime, is that they don't allow the kind of failure course corrections that you would have in kind of an open society where there's lots of failure, lots of things going. And so that means that you're kind of blocking and until the failures happen in a big way and they overcome everything. And so for me, the advantages of open societies and open systems is that you have your failures happen fast, frequently, and forward. And that's the problem with this current system in China, is they're not having their failures fast and small enough.
You write, we are not a body that carries a soul. We are a soul that is assigned a body, not of our choosing, but in our care.
Yeah.
That seems very theological. Is that related to your religious sensibility?
I think I would say yes, it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, would be my belief.
What is your, I have read widely in your work, and, somewhere it always gets mentioned, at some point you became a Christian.
Right.
What does that mean?
It means that I see myself as a follower of Jesus, who I was raised a Catholic, and even at the point where I did not believe in God, I believed in Jesus. And it's no surprise that for me, I was always attracted to his sayings, his proverbs. And here I am, I'm writing my own proverbs.
Next book is Parables and then Revelations. You've got your whole writing program ahead of you.
Someone called my book The Bible Without Stories, which I thought was pretty cool. And so I'm a follower of Jesus. I believe in a kind of a cosmic Jesus. I mean, I think that the act of a God taking upon itself the paradox of free will. And the outcome of free will is that you allow beings to choose harm to others. And so if you're a God and you have a universe and you're making and you allow beings to do harm, what's the remedy for that harm? Do you allow it? Is there a punishment? How can you punish it if it's something that you love? And so that tension between mercy and justice is absorbed by the being, the creator itself. It says, okay, you asked me, so I'm telling you a story.
No, absolutely.
But go ahead.
Well, what I was going to say is that where is salvation? Because what Jesus does in a Christian theology is that he gives mercy. He allows people to choose poorly. He himself becomes human, but then he saves us through his sacrifice. What is the salvation in your
salvation probably is different on every planet, but the idea is that you have the creatorhood takes upon itself the punishment that is deserved is absorbed by the creator. And in our case, our story is that you have the godhood suffer the pain of punishment, even though it's God. So how could God possibly take punishment for take the consequences of doing that other people have done for harm upon itself. And the idea is that you have some embodiment in the world, so it can feel the discomfort, the pain of, and absorb the justice for hurting others.
This may be unbelievably and banal, but is that part of the way it maps onto your belief in emergent order? I mean, it's a kind of feedback loop of the pain and the suffering. So then you change the behavior, you change the system, and that's how it self-regulates?
I didn't really make that extension. But I think the extension that I make came from thinking about VR and making AIs. It's okay. We're now in the position of being creators. So part of the theology is that we are made in the image of the creator. So we are ourselves going to make beings that can feel and think, and they will have free will at some point. And their question is when one of these beings does something that's harmful to others, what are we going to do as creators? What's our stance on this? Who is responsible? If we make an AI robot that decides on its own to kill a human, what's our society response? Who's responsible? Is it the makers of the robot? Is it the robot itself, which has some degree of free will? How do we say that there's consequences for things at the same time that we are being merciful and just? And so I think we're going to wrestle with a lot of these things, and I think we may find that traditional religions have something to suggest to us as we become gods. This is the Stuart Brand thing. We are as gods and we'll get good at. So I'm saying that some of these ethical things, we come back to look at what some of the solutions were in the past.
Let me ask as a kind of closing question. You know, you're of a generation, and you, as much as anyone in your kind of cohort, helped break down shackles, you know, and whether that's, you know, wearing a suit and tie to work or, you know, you know, living in a ranch house rather than a teepee, whatever. But I mean, a big part of the boomer, you know, the best part of the boomer generation was kind of tearing down structures, repressive apparatuses, you know, forms and frameworks that were just not working anymore, just repressing people. This is implicit in a lot of the advice that you give, but younger people now, oftentimes they were raised in a world of abundance and a world of choice. And, you know, you can be anybody you want. You can be anything you want. They definitely on some level had less structured upbringings than war babies might have had, people growing up in the 50s and 60s. In other ways, they were much more regimented, but part of what your work does is it seems to be recognizing the need to get rid of the old and to, you know, constantly being born, but then create structures that serve the function that older traditions did without being as repressive. Is that kind of an essential key that we need, you know, human societies in order to flourish need structure? They need regulation, ideally done, you know, kind of as an emergent order rather than as a top-down thing. And how do we keep that going? Because it seems like younger people now are calling in many ways for more structure in their life and demanding more. Mm-hmm.
I think your observations are very, very astute. I am famous for writing a book about decentralized systems and the power of these very flat, bottom-up decentralized systems to accomplish things. But I amended that in my second book to indicate that the bottom, decentralized, flat, can get you further than you ever believed, but isn't going to go all the way, that you need a certain element of the top-down structure that imposed from the top. And that ratio is probably fairly small, but nonetheless, you need to have that. And that we saw that with Wikipedia, which in the beginning was completely decentralized, but over time they added more levels of control from the top and freezing things and all that kind of stuff. And that's the only way you're going to get to the ideal encyclopedia that you want. And I think we're seeing the same thing right now happening with AI, which in the beginning is going to be very decentralized, large language models that are very, very flat. There's going to be some element of structured from the top symbolic reasoning that you need in order to get as far as you want. And we see that again in democracy, where you have lots of decentralized stuff, but you have to have some order or something from the top guiding it. So I think to your question about the current generation, I think we're still evolving and inventing what kinds of structures that we want, because I think we do need them. I think we cannot have just a complete open-ended, flat, featureless system where the only thing you have are connections between each other. I think we do need to have civilizational scale structures. And, you know, Stuart Brand's famous for his pace layering thing, which I think is true, which is that we need to have structures appropriate to the speed at which they're running. And part of what we're inventing right now are what are the structures that we need for really these fast moving stuff that we haven't really had before. So I'm optimistic as usual. And I think that this generation is in part having to invent some of these things. When we have social media that's moving so fast, what are some of the structures? What are we allowed to say and not say? We haven't thought about that. We have these things that we, AIs and others that are trained on humans, but we don't, they're kind of behaving like the average human, but we're not going to accept that because we say it's like, no, we want them better than us. What does that even mean? So I think I think you're right that there is some new structure needed, and the young understand that. I think they're going to invent that. I think that's what we're in the process of, is making another layer, another variety of structure that can operate not the glacial cultural scale, but at some other scale, the speed of technology.
Final question. Are you confident that your children will live in a better world than you?
Absolutely. Now, that's easy for me to say, because I would say my kids are privileged, being born in America, being born of the parents that they are, having the education they have. But I would say that on average, globally, I would say, yes, the children born today of parents, on the average globally, will live better lives, meaning they will live longer, have more security, have more options, have more choices than their parents do.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Kevin Kelly, thanks for talking to Reason.
My pleasure. Thank you for asking fantastically great questions. I really appreciate your spirit.
The new book is Excellent Advice for Living, Wisdom I Wish I'd Known Earlier.
This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Before you do anything else, please go to Apple, to Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, and sign up, subscribe. We're putting out 2 episodes a week. Don't miss a single one. Or you can make it super easy on yourself by going to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. Subscribe at reason.com/podcasts. And while you're there, check out the Reason Roundtable and the SOHO Forum Debates, our 2 other regular series. It's all great stuff. If you like the Reason Interview, you're going to love the Reason Roundtable and the SOHO Forum Debates. So go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up, subscribe to all of them. Never miss an episode. Thanks for listening.